But how did you come into such a work then, Mrs. Sowerby?
I think I was born into it because my father was in the magistrates' courts in the Gorbals, and mother was a passionate church worker. And at the age of about 14, I was running a girls' group in a church. So in that sense, always. But more professionally, when I left school and I was in Liverpool and read in the papers that Carr Saunders had been appointed as professor at the Department of Social Science. Yes. And so then I came to take a degree course. So perhaps that's the sort of formal moment.
Yes. What year would that be? Can you remember the year?
Oh, about 1920. It's in this manuscript, which I'm going to give you. 1922, that kind of time.
Yes. So what sort of things did students, preoccupied students, on the social science course at Liverpool at that time? What were they?
They weren't students in our sense. They were middle-class ladies and vicars and people of that sort who did voluntary work, and they realised they needed to be trained.
I see.
And the only two who were in any way professionals were two men who came up through the WEA and had scholarships.
I see.
And they were all taking a two-year certificate,
and
I was taking a degree.
I see.
And it was the first degree course.
Yes. And, can you remember what the subjects were, and what did they regard as training for that work?
Social structure was the great thing, and social statistics, this was a very new subject for ordinary people to take, and we had a very dried up man called Caradoc Jones, which was a terrible subject, horrible subject, and the great Professor Alexander, who gave the degree students only 6 weeks combined psychology and philosophy, which was quite something. I can't remember what it was, but I can remember the man, because he was a real sage with a long white beard which he combed with his fingers.
Yes.
But I was none the wiser. Hegel, nothing like that penetrated me, and that was a degree course.
Yes.
And then my course particularly, my special subject was chosen for me, everything was chosen for me, was slavery, in which I had no interest whatsoever. And so I plodded around all the African subjects, studying slavery, but I suppose it was a social institution and that was why. But it wasn't relevant, not to me.
Yes. And did you yourself do this with a view to eventually becoming a social worker? Is that what you had in mind at the time?
I don't think so. I don't remember having an object in mind. I was absolutely entranced by Liverpool.
Yes.
And the whole thing, the housing, of course, was terrible. And the education, and the children with bare feet, and the sense of this packed city, jam-packed with people. And how did it work? What made it tick? What did they all think about? And I was so absorbed in that that I don't think there was an end product in my mind. But I think officially the hope was that they would turn out an academic type who would be way above social workers, and we would go into the civil service and research and so on.
Yes.
But I think it very soon became apparent I wasn't that quality.
Is that connected with the ploy, I believe, the Webbs had in mind? Weren't the Webbs, when they founded LSE, weren't they on the lookout for young graduates who they could then get
and
into
you were
civil service?
To be really high flyers intellectually, and you were to give your minds to all these social problems instead of being all emotional about it.
Yes.
And certainly Carr Saunders was quite remarkable. I've got it all written down for you. I'll lend you this copy.
Yes.
But he was, I think, way ahead of all of us, certainly of his times, that he saw the group as the unit of survival for the human race.
Yes.
And we've lost all that. We We smash up all these communities and we harp on about individuals.
Yes.
And I think the message he got needs to be revived.
Yes.
And that, I think, would be why he set me to study slavery. This was a social institution and so on. I can see the sense in it now, but it made no sense at the time.
So what happened when you graduated? What did you do with yourself when you finished?
Well, that was totally dismaying, because by then, it can't have been 22, it must have been later, but anyhow, by then was getting on for 1930, 31. And the peak of the slump, there just wasn't a hope of a job. And anyway, I did so badly, out of pity, they gave me a 3-2. They couldn't fail their first student, they had to let me through. And therefore, no civil service would look at me. And I wasn't trained to do social work, I'd been trained a cut above that. And so, entirely, by stroke of luck, I got the job of youth leader in the girls' club in Buxton. But I wasn't trained for that either, except that I'd run these things at churches and schools and things.
Who was your employer when you...
Oh, that was a private ladies' committee in Buxton.
Really? How and did they work? What was that?
Oh, they were the good old traditional voluntary society.
Yes.
And they were the employers, and I was the kind of upper parlourmaid level.
Really?
And so they tried to run their committees, and I was sent for when they wished me to be present.
Yes.
And so I knew enough about things to know that wasn't on, and so I never told them anything. And so very quickly they realised that they couldn't get on without me, and so I was allowed to be present at committees.
Yes.
But that was still in the straight Victorian tradition. They raised the money and they decided everything, and I took the orders.
Was it a formal organisation, or was it just a group of well-intentioned ladies?
Well-intentioned ladies, but they'd been got together. I don't remember who got them together. This was Buxton. Because the government had a scheme for offering employment to the daughters of miners in the northeast, and they offered them jobs in hotels in Buxton. And because they were having such problems with them, they were wild young women.
Yes.
And because they were having such problems with them, they got this group to open up a club as a home from home.
Yes.
And that was my job. I was expected to be there from midday till 10:30 at night, every day of the week, including weekends. And through the night, if the police picked any of them up, either run away from their hotels or on the loose, they were brought to me. I had to take them in and do rescue work.
So
it was a real old-fashioned job description. I mean, no person could do it. No one person.
So, I mean, although you describe yourself as a group worker, in that particular instance, you were also having to work with individuals.
Yeah, they brought as you a rescue worker.
Difficult. Can you remember any incidents or anecdotes of that time? Can you remember what it was like?
One particularly. I don't know if you know the Northeast, but I admire them immensely. They've got such vitality. And this was a strapping great lass. And she was bored to tears with these hotels filled with old women, all refugees from the war, you know, and old ladies and that. And she filled in her time picking men up on the marketplace, which is where the club was.
Yes.
And she taught me everything about sex. I was just 21 or 22. She taught me everything. Cool. And when I got to court as a magistrate in the end, I realised that I owed all my knowledge to her.
Yes.
And out of it, they shrieked with laughter at my inexperience, the things I didn't know.
Yes.
And I was equally shaken by the things they didn't know. Mm-hmm. They didn't know, they'd never been to a theatre. You can imagine coming from some Durham mining village. And all that my public school had taught me, and all the appreciation of poetry and all this, was as stunning to them as their experience was to me.
Yes.
And so I used to take them to the theatre, And the Russian ballet came to Buxton in those days. And it was, I think it was there I really acquired, as a principle, mutual self-respect.
Yes.
I found it very hard going.
Yes.
Quite shattering, far more shattering than anything they taught me at the university.
Yes.
But I think if out of that I acquired the principle of mutual self-respect as the basis of all social work, I think it wasn't without profit.
Yes, indeed, yes. I don't want to press you too hard on things that were a long, long time ago and probably you haven't thought about for ages, but I just wonder whether you could remember any more anecdotes of those days and just the sort of thing you said, you were on call during the night and the police would call you out. I mean, can you remember the sort of things the police would call you out of bed about and what you were expected to do about them?
Well, they would knock me up. It was an enormous Victorian house, with 4 or 5 floors, and I had the top flat. And in the middle of the night, you'd have to go down and take in some totally strange girl. And I think what strikes me now is my extraordinary innocence. Mm. I would open the door and take in some bedraggled creature. I mean, without a pang, conduct her upstairs, she could have belted me and robbed me. And it never entered my head. And think maybe it protected me because I wasn't frightened. And I would make them tea and we'd sit and talk a bit and I'd put them to bed. And the next day probably they'd beat it before the police could catch up with them. Yeah. But the university course hadn't prepared me at all. And I think that's why the girl who was on the street so shattered me. I never imagined anything like that happened. But then in the end, friends from Liverpool, professional social workers, who came over to see me, they all loved to come. They used to come for holidays, free holidays in Buxton.
Yes.
Made it very clear that I had to grasp that VD might come my way, or theft, or all manner of unpleasant things. The girls might let men in or something, and they interviewed my committee and told them that this must stop. And so that whole branch of the work was stopped totally.
But your social work friends from Liverpool intervened on your
behalf?
Yeah,
and interviewed the committee.
Yes.
I don't think the committee had thought about it either.
No.
We were bunch of innocent middle-class women.
What sort of things were your friends doing then in Liverpool? Were these people new from the course, or you'd met?
One would be Dorothy Keeling, who ran Personal Service Society.
Gosh, you knew her.
Oh, yes. And Janet McCrindle, who was one of the first ever who had taken the sanitary worker certificate, because there was no social work certificate.
Yeah.
And she trained me a lot in youth work. I did a great deal as a student.
Yeah.
And people of that generation.
You were with her as a student, were you?
Voluntarily. It wasn't part of my course.
Yes.
The course had no practical work whatsoever. It was strictly theoretical.
Yes.
But she got me roped into one of the leading girls' clubs, which was a real education, down by the docks. And it was on the strength of that kind of reference that I suppose I got the job. She was a very competent youth leader indeed.
I hadn't heard of her. I've heard of Dorothy Keeling.
Yeah. Oh, and Joey Duck. Yes. Josephine Duckworth was another of the great pioneers.
Yes.
And these were all involved with the women's movement. They appeared on the scene immediately after the 1918 peace.
Yes.
And they took over as the women's leader in what was a woman's world.
Yes.
And therefore, the clubs were all girls' clubs.
Yes.
It was entirely a woman's world.
Yes. Did you come across Letty Harford as well?
Because she was the national, or coming up to being a national figure in the whole youth field.
Yes.
And so I'm sure her interview would interlock with that one.
Yes. And
she would know Josephine Duckworth because she used to come up and visit.
Yes. Yes, she, well, when I saw her, yes, she also mentioned Elizabeth McAdam.
Oh, yeah.
And she was in the
Oh, yes. Mm. It was all... It's all very interlocked. We all knew each other.
Yes.
And you knew each other nationally.
Yes.
And
did you ever get locked into any kind of discussion with these celebrities? Were you ever...
We argued immensely, but in those days about... it was the beginning of the state takeover.
Yes.
And that developed in the 30s.
Yes.
And people like Joey Duck, who's in this chapter that I'm giving you anyway,
yes.
People like Joey Duck had an acute sense of respect for the individual. And this was what I came back from Buxton with, you see.
Yes.
The mutual self-respect.
Mm.
And Joey Duck would not have the state overrule even... a waitress who was out on the streets.
Sorry?
Joey Duck wouldn't have the state overrule that girl. If that girl said, I am a member of the Buxton Girls Club and I want jazz music, the state must not be allowed to say, you will have Beethoven.
Yes.
Though we might all think the state was right.
Mm.
And Joey Duck was a passionate defender and argued till the cows came home.
Yes.
About this whole principle of what you mean by democracy.
Yes.
In terms of the most scruffy junior girl in a youth club.
Is this what all that argument about statism is all about that I've read in the old COS reviews?
Don't recollect the word.
Multiple articles which use the word statism in the title,
think that
and they
would
seem
be
to be
it.
Talking about collectivist legislation versus volunteers and the state would do if it took over.
But at that stage, the state was only a cloud on the horizon, you know, palm of a man's hand.
Yes.
And what we were debating was, do you oppose it?
Yes.
Or do you accept that it's got to come, it's got to grow?
Yes.
And if so, what will the partnership be? I don't think we ever guessed that the day would come when the state would take completely over.
Yes.
And voluntaries would be away outside the state.
What was your view of that at the time? What were your thoughts about it? Can you remember?
Oh, totally of the school that insignificant individuals were top priority. And I would suspect that stems from having grown up in a man's world and seeing women's suffrage come, we're acutely conscious of being substandard citizens.
Yes.
And we were the first generation to be out. And though we grieved secretly, though we pined for the husbands we would never get, nevertheless, we're madly excited to be out and free. And therefore, we weren't going to have the state put its foot on us.
Yes.
And our freedom, insignificant women though we were, that was the thing that mattered.
Yes, yes.
And it was all involved with our own personal escape, which I think gave it that intensity, that passion.
Yes.
Which you don't know unless you've met it. I think you might meet it now among the British-born blacks round in my ward.
Yes.
That kind of self-awareness and not anything in the world is allowed to trample on you. And therefore, in a way, a great fear of the state, and yet looking at all the unemployed round us, there was no other answer. You couldn't deal with unemployment, housing, education on a voluntary basis.
Yes.
It had to be done by the planned society.
Yes.
And it was, where did we fit in as voluntaries?
Mm.
And we wouldn't go and work for the state. When my tutors put it to me, I ought to make a bid for the civil service. That was going over to the enemy to me.
Yes.
Nothing would induce me to work for the state. That was too demeaning.
Yes. So what were your thoughts then about the Webbs and that little group? Because they were...
I don't think they made much impact on us. We were practitioners.
Mm.
Most of my friends had gone into casework.
Yes.
And they were totally swamped by bad housing, poverty. Mm. Just imagine the present slump with no dole.
Yes.
God. And therefore, they were swamped with casework, and people like me, whose mind ran on social structure and that, were struggling with this whole business of trying to get the new estate, get clearance schemes through. The whole practical pressure was such that I don't think we ever gave thought to the Webbs or anybody very much.
You were saying before that there was some peculiar argument about whether one could still be a volunteer yet receive a salary.
Oh, yes. That one really baffled us, quite right, too.
Can you explain what that was all about and who was saying what?
Well, the great... This, I think, is where we went wrong. The great, I suppose nowadays we'd say dichotomy, was between the state and the voluntary. Nowadays we try to say non-stats. And to us, the magic, democracy, all those kind of things, lay in the word voluntary.
Yes.
And yet we were faced with the fact that most of us had taken some kind of professional training. We thought of ourselves as professionals, and we were paid. And that didn't fit the old Victorian label of voluntary. And so we had to struggle with ourselves. If you worked for a youth club and were hopelessly underpaid, in some way you were morally superior to the youth club worker paid a nice teacher's salary by the education committee.
I see, yes.
And if you gave up and accepted the nice salary, and that you were, somehow you had betrayed yourself. And I remember my husband in the very early days saying, but some of these civil servants in the public assistance department are good practicing Christians. How can you say that they're morally inferior?
Yes.
Dear, oh dear, how we anguished.
Yes.
Bit difficult to see the point now, but it still crops up over things like partnership and urban aid. To this day, there is an indefinable distinction between the Citizens Advice Bureau, all that lot, who are big organisations paying proper salaries, and the people we call grassroots nowadays, who are to us the genuine article and somehow have a magic. And we haven't sorted that one out yet. That's what this previous committee was all about.
So, how long did you stay at Buxton with the Girls Club then?
Not very long, because I was there about a year, I suppose, and an ambitious woman from Manchester eyed me up and decided I was what she needed for the Manchester and Salford and District Union of Girls Clubs. And so I was offered the job of full-time secretary at £120 a year, non-resident. And off I went, because the Buxton Club really was too heavy a load. And it was very isolated, very Victorian. And so I fell for temptation very easily. And off I went to live in Manchester. And there, I did what any youth organisation secretary would do nowadays. You organise competitions and you run conferences and you try to promote reading. And then you deal with the local authority. And I covered from Buxton to Rochdale, including the whole of Manchester and the whole of Salford, and it was the heyday of girls' clubs. There were clubs on every street.
Yes.
That was lunacy too, to try and do that one single-handed. A slightly better committee, they were of the tradition of Manchester women, and they had, they were on the city council, and the Pilkington daughters were on the committee, and Lady Crossley of Crossley Motors.
Yes.
They were a much better educated bunch than the Buxton ones, and therefore much easier to work for.
Yes.
That was a very interesting job. I loved it, but on that money, it wasn't possible to live. I lived at the Roundhouse with Lowry and Mary Stocks and people like that.
Nice.
But the fee was £2 a week, and I got less than £3.
Yes.
And so, looking back on it, I think foolishly, I went and lived in lodgings. We were terribly poor in those days as social workers.
Yes. Mm. Did you have links with other social workers as secretary?
Hardly at all, because I spent all my mornings in the office. I had to do all the typing and all the duplicating things, and of course we'd none of the photocopiers or anything we have nowadays. I did all my own minutes. I did everything all myself.
Goodness.
And raised all the money.
Goodness.
And that took the day, and then from, say, 4 o'clock onwards, I was speeding off to the likes of Rochdale or so on. We'd got to... Where had we got to?
Oh, you're telling me about Manchester. I think I'd asked you whether you...
Oh, whether we met other people. No, and I was saying, then I went out at night, and by the time you'd gone on the bus, because nobody had cars, to Rochdale and found the place and stayed there till 10 at night and then got yourself home. There wasn't any opportunity. And that one again, I think, just like Buxton, turned out to be awfully lonely, except that I had this good committee.
Did you keep contact with these friends you mentioned, Janet McCrindle, Dorothy Keeling, Jasmine?
Oh, yes, but then they were in Liverpool, and I didn't meet their opposite numbers in Manchester.
Yes. Yes. So how
I've kept in, to this day I'm in touch with the ones who are alive still.
Yes. Yes. So what happened after?
Well, in the end I had to give it up because I just starved myself to death. You just couldn't live on that kind of money. And so I had to give it up. And so I came home and had a long rest cure and then went and was a dietitian for a little while. A dietitian's apprentice.
Yes.
In a big hospital, which was a good experience.
Yes.
And got myself latched onto the first psychologist who practiced in Liverpool, a man called Alan Fitch.
Yes.
And I was his receptionist. Which was quite interesting.
Yes.
And then got back in when I was recovered again, back into the mainstream. It was a job which I got because I knew people like McCrindle and so on. They were the key figures.
Yes.
And meanwhile, the big survey of Merseyside, which Booth had always meant to do, but didn't, was going, and there were all those young men were around.
Yes, that was Caradog Jones.
That was why he came to run the statistical side of it.
Yes.
And there were all of them, and I knew all of them, and therefore, between them, they got me this research project, it's a grand name, which was not to go and work for unemployed young women, but to go and discover what they needed, what help could we offer. And this came through the Girls Club movement. And it was a 6-month project, and we started off and the only way we knew that you lay on a program of lectures and classes and things. And I went, I think I was very brave, very middle class, and I went and handed out leaflets to all the women waiting at the Dole, waiting at the Labour Exchange, saying, wouldn't you like to come join my club and that? They must have laughed, I think, and nobody came. So that was the end of that, and instead we focused on the two or three that looked like going, which were latched on to existing community work. And one was a Catholic community centre around in the Bullring here, and two were out on Dovecot and Norris Green housing estates, where there were resident groups.
I see. Yes.
And I could do PT because I'd been to a public school, and I could cook because my mother was a Scot. And I did things, demonstrations, like five ways of cooking a herring. Really? And all we had was a primus and a biscuit tin lid. We didn't even have a frying pan. And that, just like Buxton, I think taught me this immense respect for the people that I encountered.
Yes.
It was beyond me to imagine, I could only do it because they taught me, that you could ever live where you cooked on a primus with a biscuit tin lid, and that was your kitchen equipment. And yet be upstanding and cheerful and hilariously good company.
Yes.
And so at the end of that 6 months, I had to try to write my report.
Yes.
Oh. And then I realized that university had taught me nothing. I couldn't write. But in the end, I produced a little report. And it was because the Manchester Guardian reviewed it as a leader that my husband read it and said, that's the girl for me.
Yes.
And the conclusion we came to, and I owed this to Joey Duck, that she insisted on it being said, was that this project had proved we didn't need it. That was not what was wanted. We didn't need special provision for unemployed young women. That they sink back into the community when they're unemployed, back into their families, and they don't regard themselves as unemployed. They regard themselves as the community, as ordinary people. And that what we must supply was women's clubs. There was a desperate need for that. All manner of activities that would bring women out of the house. That was desperately needed, but nothing at all for the unemployed as the unemployed. And that's a lesson we've still not learned. And we're not doing that even now, 1980. And so out of that one, it's a great thing if you know the right people. By that time, McCrindle was no longer warden of the David Lewis Girls Club. She'd become organiser of the new movement, Townswomen's Guilds. Which was to match women's institutes in the country and be a town version. And so I became her secretary part-time. And the other part of my time, I helped her to run a house. And she'd inherited the family house around the corner from here and took in lodgers. In those days, you provided bed and board. And it was full of first-generation professional women. One doing improved houses, Octavia Hill trained, and a solicitor struggling to make her way as a woman solicitor, and various professional women, about 6 or 7 of them. So I ran the house and I acted as her secretary. And that really was immense fun. We had all this Merseyside survey team hanging about the house, because they were all young men in flats, and I was quite a good cook, I think. And so they came around the house a great deal. Endless debates and arguments. We were all very pro-Russia. And various young men who subsequently became MPs. The one who's now the father of the House of Commons, George Darling, was one of them. And so on. And though we grieved that we didn't get married, because that was such a shame and a disgrace not to be married. But apart from knowing that we ought to be disgraced, God, how we enjoyed it. And you got your own money, maybe only £2 or £3 a week, but it was yours. And you had no family, no responsibilities, and you went to lectures and concerts. We were very, very avant-garde. We did Yeats plays in our spare time and played the harp. All that kind of thing. But that happiness And that total commitment to our jobs, I think we've lost nowadays. Mm. And of course it meant that to us, as there wasn't marriage as a prospect, the job was the thing.
Yes.
And you never, never questioned that you were badly paid and badly treated and hopelessly overworked. The job mattered so much. And therefore we just took over social work. And we made it our thing, and it wasn't man's territory at all. And we must have influenced the whole development of social work, I think. Up till 1918, people like Carl Saunders were the outstanding figures, but after 1918, it was McAdam and Young Hersman, all that lot, just commandeered the place, pushed the men right over the horizon.
Yes. They're more forceful, do you think?
Not more forceful, but more driven. And to have grown up through that war and had brothers killed and fathers killed, you had to justify your survival.
Yes.
And if you met people, if you met men who were handicapped, who were broken by the war, you had to look them in the face and say, I was saved because I'm serving humanity. And that kind of drive, I think we're all slightly crazy.
It's all very reminiscent of the Vera Brittain and Testament of Youth.
Yeah, it was all that generation. You see, we read Vera Brittain and Hopi, all that generation of people.
Yes. So what year are we talking about when you were living?
It would be up to about 37 or 8. 37. And then, you see, one of this team of young men came my way, I would be 29, if I was born in 1907. And it was 29. What date would that be?
36.
Is that right? Anyway. And of course I was so thrilled, so excited at the age of 29 to have caught a husband, and a nice one. You know, he wasn't a make-do, he really was a winner. And so when his mother said firmly, you will live in suburbs, I wasn't going to argue.
Yes.
Off I went, vanished over the horizon. And that's why in writing my own book I'm in a difficulty.
Yes.
Because it was all a bit second hand.
Yes.
He was writing his book, which interestingly was on the principles of social administration. Because social administration was totally new, and the local government servants who'd gone into it, they knew about education administration and highways and emptying the bins and that, but social administration raised all manner of problems, such as where the voluntaries come in. There's a whole chapter in it on the voluntary, and particularly the relationship between local provision, stat and non-stat, and national.
Yes.
And by then we'd accepted that national, the planned society, was there, was no longer coming, it was with us. But how, where did you draw the line between total national takeover and the defence of local democracy?
Yes.
And that really is what that whole book was about.
Yes.
And therefore I was in on all that, all his discussions with his colleagues, and I corrected all the proofs. But it wasn't actually in the front line anymore. So it's difficult to know how to write about that. Well, then come the war, off he went to do sundry jobs. And anyhow, got offered the job in the West Indies, which would be about 1940. We were well into the Blitz by then. The Liverpool Blitz was nearly over.
Yes. Were you here during the Liverpool Blitz then?
Yeah, not in this house. I was out in the suburbs, he was here.
Were you in contact with the work that the PAC did amongst the...
What I did come across at first hand was the evacuees.
Yes.
And West Kirby in those days was extremely conventional. Mm. Not like some suburbs where they're fairly relaxed. It really was extraordinarily conventional. And when all these evacuees arrived, they were full of noble thoughts. Mm. But within 10 minutes, they were all being bundled back to town. And we offered to take a mother and child.
Yes.
Because we hadn't any spare bedroom, but we said we could give them the dining room. We didn't need a dining room and a drawing room.
Yes.
It was an ordinary, detached suburban house. And so we volunteered to take a mother and baby. Mm. But nobody would take. They came from Scotland Road, our lot, and the very sight of them, they began to be rejected locally. And so we fetched up with a mother and three children, and father, who arrived out at the weekends, and they all lived in the dining room together, and we shared a kitchenette. I don't know how we managed. Oh dear. And they were a family who'd just been involved. The man's brother was up for trial on a murder. And that really was quite an experience. And all our neighbours, of course, were in fearful trouble with their evacuees. Mm. And my husband did a bit of research on evacuees, which was all printed in there. Mm. Yes. It was all... The message was that we didn't know each other. Mm. And that did hit home locally. And that was why Beveridge got such a good reception.
Yes.
That it really brought home to people the gulf in standards. Mm. And though they couldn't cope with it in their own houses, quite forgivably, they accepted Beveridge that this sort of thing couldn't go on. Mm. And I think the evacuee scheme really prepared the way for Beveridge. But by that time, we'd gone to the West Indies.
Yes. Yes, you were telling me last time the whole story of that. Can you
tell
that again? You made it sound a really quite frightening experience in some ways.
What was frightening was that we went out in good faith. We only went because they said there was such trouble in the West Indies, and the Americans were prepared to pack their bags and go home if these niggers weren't kept in their place. And there was desperate need for welfare reforms and so on, and would my husband go out? And I was to go because of all my group work experience. And we could take the child. And so on those terms, as part of a whole team, off we went. And when we got there, we discovered all this apartheid and all the rest of it, and found ourselves in the end in danger of being put in a concentration camp because we would talk to blacks. And my husband became the advisor to the independence movement in all the islands, Trinidad, Jamaica, Barbados, all of them. Mm. And that was where, I think, both of us felt our real education had come.
Yes, yes.
And I came out of that 5 years, as I ought to have come out of the university, with a grip on basic principles. And a real, not a theoretical clue, but a real grip of what I was in this world for, where I was headed. Very little idea of how you got there, but I just knew that was where my face was going.
Yes, yes.
And I think maybe you don't come out of the university with that.
Yes.
But it was a totally different feeling. And we came back and looked at Liverpool, and it just wasn't on. That university life, going home 9 till 4, 3 months off in the summer, it wasn't on anymore at all. That wasn't what life was about. Mm. So we got rid of all that and moved to this house, which became an annex to the university and an annex to my ward. And the two met in this house deliberately.
So I think by this time you'd decided that social work was not the answer and that political activity was.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it was the West Indies that taught us that. That though you're basic is what the Buxton Lass has taught me, mm-hmm. that basic respect for the individual mm-hmm. as the main plank, the machinery, the metaphor's getting a bit mixed, planks and the machinery, mm-hmm. but the strategy has to be political.
Yes.
And that, of course, was fed into my life by Eleanor Rathbone when I had come up to Liverpool straight from school.
Yes.
And her whole concept was that you were a citizen and that was your reason for living. And how you were a citizen, whether you were a doctor or scrubbed floors, didn't really matter as long as you were a full-time, full-stretch citizen. And therefore, in the West Indies, respect for the most illiterate, roughest mm. black man, mm. but your strategy was citizenship.
Yes.
And how did you enable him to be a contributing citizen? Mm. And when we came back and looked at Liverpool, that was the recipe, that was what was lacking.
Yes.
And so we moved in here so that my husband could bring all, I suppose it's the old Webb Fabian stuff, mm-hmm. my father knew them, he worked with them at the LSE. Yes. He brought in all the intelligentsia, the academics, the wide knowledge, people like Margaret Mead and Titmus and all that, and I brought in the rough black man from round the corner.
But he brought them into this house?
He brought his lot here, yes. and I brought my lot here.
Really?
And inevitably they met.
At the same time?
Not ever deliberately.
No.
But because they were my friends and those others were his friends, mm-hmm. we assumed. And my husband had a great gift for being unself-conscious.
Yes.
I like to think maybe I have it a bit too. As a Scot, I think we're not so class-conscious. Mm-hmm. And my husband...